Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amanda Kennel, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, I'll be speaking with Lucy Fraser, the author of The Pleasures of Metamorphosis, Japanese and English Fairy Tale Transformations of the Little Mermaid. As the title suggests, the book examines various adaptations of Hans Christian Andersen's short story, The Little Mermaid. Short stories, films, novels, and a television show that were made across the late 19th, 20th, and early 21st centuries in Japan and the United States provide a fascinating glimpse of how this Danish fairy tale from 1837 has appealed to consumers and producers far removed from the context of its original publication. Lucy Fraser, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes, I'm a senior lecturer in Japanese at the University of Queensland, which is in Brisbane, Australia. This book that we're going to talk about is based on my PhD project. And I've since kind of taken up my interest in fairy tales and retellings of fairy tales in new projects, which we might talk about later. But I spend most of my time teaching Japanese language and culture, and the research and the random service and administration jobs that come along with all of that.
I know what you mean.
Yes.
So if you're a researcher of Japanese culture, then what led you to Hans Christian Andersen and, you know, The Little Mermaid?
Yes. I was trying to remember that. just before I started my PhD, I went traveling, actually, and I was so drawn to, you know, I was visiting all the famous galleries in the UK and Europe, and I was really drawn to the visual representations of metamorphosis. And kind of these, you know, the Greek mythology being retold by later artists. I loved the stories and the pictures of people turning from human to animal and vice versa. And I think I wanted to start to think about that theme in Japanese literature and Japanese stories, which was already kind of my area of interest. And then I do think, of course, we had to narrow the topic eventually, and I think my mentor and advisor, Tomoko Aoyama, had this long-term interest in mermaids and was very keen to draw me into that project. So I think that's why I ended up being mermaids rather than stories of metamorphosis more generally.
And that certainly sort of comes through in the book. I think you're always talking about the ways that the story changes, but also the characters in the story change and sort of how we understand it. Like there's so much sort of shifting and sliding that occurs throughout the course of your book. It's really fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And I say that, you know, I've use the word adaptation here, but you prefer the word transformation. Why is that?
Yes. I was working a lot from fairy tale studies, and fairy tale studies tend to have particular terminologies for the way fairy tales are changed and retold. And so we have retellings or revisions or parodies. And, of course, adaptations. And none of them seem to apply to the huge variety of texts that I had, apply to cover all of the variety of texts that I had ended up looking at. Transformations is kind of an overall term, a bit inspired by this Christina Bakalega, who's a wonderful fairy tale studies scholar who uses that in another book title. What else was I going to say about that? And also because the PhD thesis began as a study that was much more focused on the type of the process of change that was occurring. And so the chapters were divided up into different types of transformation. And adaptation was just one of those types, and I focused on Linda Hutcheon's theory of adaptation that looks at the shift across forms, really, so being adapted from short story to film and so on, and how that affects the way that the story is retold. So it was kind of just a technical issue, really, about labelling all of these different types of change that really resist any kind of pigeonholing.
That is ultimately the real challenge with a topic that, as I said, shifts so much. How do you pin it down? And I feel like the word transformation does get at that sense of constant movement very neatly. And also, when you were telling us about sort of how you came up with the topic of the book, you mentioned sort of going back to, you know, ancient Greek materials. I always thought of Anderson's The Little Mermaid as sort of being original in and of itself, but does it have earlier antecedents?
Yes, definitely. And I've been trying to, I feel like I've kind of lost my book. I'm not so close to it anymore, because I've been distracted by other things, so I was trying to revisit it. But there have been mermaid stories, it feels like, forever, in all sorts of places around the world. And I think for Anderson, yes, those kind of Greek and then Roman mythologies, which had fed into this kind of use of mermaids as kind of these sinful temptress figures of sexuality, used to warn Christian congregations, you know, throughout, medieval and Renaissance kind of periods. So I think Anderson was quite, it seems that he was quite I don't want to say proud of himself, but engaged with his idea of this, of representing the mermaid as a more romantic and tragic and sentimental and childlike figure, as a kind of response to those earlier depictions that he would have known very well. And there were some other Undine and Melusine stories that he was also adapting, I guess, in his own version.
Now, immediately when you talk about sort of the youthful Little Mermaid, I think of probably the most famous version of the story, which is the Disney film, right?
Yes.
And I, of course, pair it also in my mind with Studio Ghibli's Ponyo on the Clift, probably is the second most famous version of.
Oh, yes. Difficult to decide, yeah.
they're very different works. What did you make of them?
Yes. You know, when you read a Disney film, everything has to be filtered through Disney as a studio and Disney as a narrative and Disney as its own genre, doesn't it? And, you know, I think Anderson brought in that theme of adolescence and what he views as a very painful transformation from childhood into kind of adult sexuality and as well as adult kind of identity and sense of self. And I think so Disney were very keen to pick up on that element. And I feel as though they're very self-congratulatory about this rebellious teenage girl figure that they've created without any self-awareness about her counterpart, the aging kind of gender transgressive witch who causes all the problems for the young girl. But you know, Disney's quite irresistible, I think, for a kind of literary and cultural studies person. There's so much to talk about there. And I really enjoyed writing about that film because of all those possibilities. I think what is interesting is that feminists, as a feminist, it's very easy to analyse Anderson's Little Mermaid as extremely problematic, and certainly I can agree with those ideas that this is essentially the story of someone who mutilates her body and sacrifices her own voice for the sake of a man. But what was really interesting to see that because of the kind of heavy Christian overtones of Anderson's story, actually kind of give the girl more agency and motivation for her change, because she not only wants to win the prince, she wants to win an eternal soul that humans have and mermaids do not. And so erasing that aspect of it in the Disney film actually reduces her agency and sense of self as a character. So I think it's always really interesting when we see things that go against our assumptions that old stories are going to be more sexist and reductive and boring, and that new versions will have more empowered female characters. And sorry, you asked about Ponyo as well, the Ghibli film, which I think many people would not automatically connect with mermaids. I don't know. Do you think you would have thought of that as a mermaid movie?
I mean, it's hard for me to say because that, you know, I'm a Japanese studies specialist who focuses on contemporary media. So
yeah.
I saw the advertising material, I think, that you mentioned in the book where they're explicitly making the comparison. Mm. So I don't know what I would have made of it had I come to the film as a blank slate, not knowing so much about what they do.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I'm curious about people's reaction to that film and whether they noticed it as a mermaid film. But of course, you know, it's Miyazaki. There's so many interesting kind of cultural references and components that are incorporated into the story and the visuals. And so what I loved about that one, you know, aside from it just being the usual wildly imaginative and engaging story, is that I could see components of Japanese mermaid stories in there as well that I wrote about a bit, and I really loved that melding of different mermaid elements that can be quite different from each other in that film. So that Ponyo does look quite grotesque in some versions of herself. She's constantly metamorphosing into different shapes, and she looks like a little jimengyo, like a person faced fish. Or a little, a Japanese-style ningyo mermaid. in different scenes, and she's kind of considered by one of the elderly ladies at the senior centre to be bad luck. And her bringing of a storm and a tsunami is also associated with Japanese stories of mermaids. So I really enjoyed all those different kind of elements being brought together in that film.
One of the things that film does that's really interesting too is that the prince character gains a personality, to put it bluntly. And you found, I think, quite a few works that actually give not just a personality, but a viewpoint all his own to that character. What is the effect of making this prince character into a more substantial person?
Because there's not really much even to Anderson's prince, and far less to Disney's kind of cardboard cutout, whose main personality is the fact that he has a dog, I think.
And he likes his dog. I remember that.
And that shows he's a good person. That's it. Dog people are good people, we say. No. And the dog recognizes the imposter, of course, when Ursula is the sea witch is disguised as a human. Yes. Oh, what is the effect of making the prince an actual character? I mean, it's just a smart narrative move to make, isn't it? To create a dynamic between those two main figures in the story. And I don't think it has to then neglect the mermaid's journey and her own transformations and struggles. I think it can create much more interest. And so, of course, again, we have this idea that girls and women in fairy tales are one-dimensional and that we need to tell their side of the story, and that's certainly true for the witch characters and the ugly stepsisters and so on. We've seen some really effective work in that area, but in this case, that's a great entry point into a new version of this story, is just telling it from the prince's view. It might not be that he's just a kind of passive idiot who kind of uses this mermaid who shows up, this mystery girl who shows up on his doorstep until something better comes along, or does what the king and queen told him to do and marry the other woman. I think, you know, it really shows that there's just so much depth to Anderson's story, and that there's still so much that can be done with it. That's what was what made it such a great text as a basis for study, is really there's so much happening there.
There's also, in a weird way, so much in the story. I mean, thinking about, for example, the Disney film, I really think, I really vividly remember from my childhood seeing Ariel sing Part of Your World, and she's just lovingly caressing and going through her collection of what I clearly remember as being garbage, right? Like a broken comb and that kind of thing. But normally when we think about fairy tales, they're all about, you know, glitz and glamour and jewels and rich furs. Has anyone transformed the Little Mermaid in that kind of luxuriant, object-focused direction?
Well, I think her obsession with her collection is, I think I wrote it in the book, it's very convenient for Disney with their endless merchandising and ongoing profits for all their associated products. And Anderson has these kind of quite vivid descriptions of the beautiful sea kingdom and the combs and things that the girls, the mermaid girls, wear in their hair and so on. And I think it must, I can't think of a specific example, sorry, but it must be there because that traditional, one of those traditional images of a mermaid is that she has a comb and a mirror and she's combing her beautiful long hair. So I think surprisingly for creatures of a natural element, they are really closely associated with treasures and objects, associated with grooming and beauty in particular. So I think that's certainly a potential. I'd have to think more on some specific examples, because right now the image you've given me is of that, you know, in Howl's Moving Castle, where his bedroom turns into this kind of tunnel and it's dripping with charms and treasures and shining jewels, and that's all I can see in my mind right now after your question.
Fascinating. One thing you write about quite a bit is the sort of, I believe they called it the Grimm boom, where female authors and manga artists sort of kicked off this fad for twisted versions of fairy tales in the late 1980s. How did that affect The Little Mermaid and its transformations?
Well, I was really working with Mayako Murai, who's a fairy tale researcher at Kanagawa University there, who very effectively traced that history of fairy tales in Japan. And really, it wasn't necessarily kicked off by women, but then taken up by women in a way, because what we think about in that trend is these kind of pop psychology analyses of the dark side of the Grimm's fairy tales. So this kind of trend, which we've seen in English as well, of saying, oh, they're not just all the censored kids' versions that we know. There's very disturbing and strange things going on in these fairy tales, and let's kind of delve into that and really enjoy those dark and scary aspects. I would say, yes, that Kurashi Yumiko's Otona no Tame no Zankoku Doha, Cruel Fairy Tales for Adults, is a great early example of that. But I guess it took on that different element of the more pop psychology and kind of other retelling. So we see, you know, more popular books that say they're retellings of, or I guess like, I don't know, let's call them light fiction or something, retellings of fairy tales that say we're going to show you the dark side of these stories that you never realized was there. I'd have to say something I really enjoy about studying literature and cross-cultural kind of literary studies in the Japanese context is that Japanese people have tended to be very well read in these kind of world fairy tales and children's literature. More Japanese people that I spoke to than English speakers knew the Anderson version of The Little Mermaid. Mm-hmm. So I would say they were quite familiar with the more dark version of this story, where the mermaid, when she becomes human, feels as though she's walking on knives with every step. And the fact that she doesn't receive a happy ending with the prince, but throws herself into the ocean and then receives what Anderson would consider a happy ending of becoming a kind of spirit with the chance to win a human soul. That's a positive outcome for him.
For him, yeah.
Yeah. So I do think there was probably quite a higher level of awareness of that dark side of the Anderson story that was slightly less overshadowed perhaps by Disney in Japan than for many English speakers, despite Disney's huge power and popularity in Japan.
That actually reminds me, too, you mentioned Kurahashi's Cruel Fairy Tales for Adults, and yet The Little Mermaid is very much a story about a younger person. What does happen to The Little Mermaid after Happily Ever After? Is there an adult version of The Little Mermaid?
Many meanings of adult here, I think.
Perhaps not the best phrasing there.
Well, the final chapter of my book, the final kind of analysis chapter, I labeled the stories I looked at, their post fairy tales. So they were kind of sequels to The Little Mermaid story, or looked at what happens when the Little Mermaid grows up, and also post as in, you know, let's not get too heavily into a discussion of postmodernism, but but all those different connotations of post as in fairy tales exist, the post-feminist take on fairy tales. And so looking at all these stories of after, and what I found in those ones is there's often stories of adults discussing explicitly Anderson's and or Disney's The Little Mermaid and their responses and preferences to that, while they themselves act out some kind of mermaid story at the same time, usually. So I think that's another way to transform a fairy tale and engage with a text, is to follow on, or, of course, imagine it in a contemporary setting. I'm thinking of the television series Dark Angel, I looked at in that chapter, in a kind of post-apocalyptic or post-economic prosperity kind of scenario. And that brings us back to darker looks at these children's stories. Does that answer your question? I don't know if I've wandered off track with that one.
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, the way actual people interact with these stories or fairy tales and such very much is, we think about them in relation to our life and our choices. So that is perhaps just a form of realism in fiction, or a merging of it in fantasy.
Which is what good fantasy does.
Absolutely. And so I've taken up, I think, a fair bit of your time. I know you're very busily booked today.
But
might I ask you what you're working on these days? You sort of briefly introduced it at the beginning, but could you tell us a little bit more?
I've been very happily busy this year with a project that is not really it's not so much of a research project yet, though hopefully it will give me some good research directions. But I've been working on a series of events, Festival of the Fantastic in Australian and Japanese Arts. This has been funded by the Australia-Japan Foundation. So our goal is to get more Australian arts enjoyed and appreciated in Japan. And that's been a lot of fun because it's taken me back to my roots, and I've been working with many fabulous people, including one of my favourite YA fantasy authors of all time, Isabel Carmody, who's an Australian author, and trying to bring people together in these two locations over their love of the fantastic arts, which we have stubbornly refused to define for the entire festival. But so, fairy tales, fantasy, speculative, horror, sci-fi, anything beyond what would be labelled realism has been involved in this festival. So we've had author interviews, artist interviews with people like Takata Fuyuhiko, who's an amazing contemporary artist who does video art where he reenacts bits of Disney's The Little Mermaid, for example. Konoike Tomoko, who does wonderful fairy tale-esque creations, and so trying to connect audiences, academics, artists and authors of the fantastic through these get-togethers and various kind of online ongoing things. So I would love if people would have a look at our website for that. It's Fantasy Arts Fest. Yes.
That is absolutely fascinating. And actually, it reminds me, I have to admit, I had my students in one of my classes this semester read part of your book.
And thank you.
They loved it.
Oh, good.
So thank you. But one of them asked me and was hoping that perhaps you could say, she wanted to know what your reaction was to the criticism that the 2023 planned live action Disney Little Mermaid film, I don't know if you've heard, but it's getting criticized for having cast Halle Bailey, a black singer, to play yes. Ariel.
How ridiculous is my reaction. I've been avoiding the online discussion of that because I find it so tedious and boring that people care that a black person is being cast in this role. They're attached to Ariel. I'm interested in the use of red hair in mermaid stories and in girls' stories. I think it has a lot of interesting connotations and symbolisms. As part of that study, I'm looking at red-headed characters in Japanese stories, and I make no distinction between artificially coloured red hair and natural red hair. I really don't think that's important. And so I don't think even an attachment to that Disney character and her particular physical features is really a justifiable reason to complain about that casting for me. I just think, you know, whoever's going to sing beautifully and inhabit the role is the right person to cast. And also, mermaid stories have been around the world for a very long time, including black people's cultures, right? This is not a strange thing to have a black person acting in the role of a mermaid if we look at the greater history of mermaids. And there's some really interesting research happening on African kind of water goddess figures. And I came across Indigenous Australian stories of river and saltwater mermaid figures. They look quite similar to other ancient cultural depictions of mermaids and have really interesting similarities to other traditions. So this is a shared figure that white people do not own. So, yes, that is my reaction to that. But mostly I'm very ignorant about the actual debate because I have no interest in engaging with those complaints.
Well, the internet, yes, the internet yes. is not always the best place to look at discussions. But thank you for telling us about that. And certainly one of the things that comes through very clearly in your book is just the amazing diversity of mermaid transformations. And I imagine that you're, was it the Fantastic Fest?
Yes.
I imagine that's going to sort of expand our understanding of the diversity available in fantasy or beyond mermaids to fantasy more generally. So thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.